This week, we'll examine some of the highlights of the United Nations General Assembly, where the ongoing war in Ukraine was a top issue for world leaders.
We as Americans and we as world countries do not condone carving up of other countries.
John Fortier, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Gita Aryan of VOA's Persian service explains the significance of the Washington-Iran prisoner exchange.
The families of these individuals put lots of pressure on the Biden administration.
And there are new details regarding three of the Iranian detainees. Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. World leaders gathered this week in New York City at the UN headquarters for the annual United Nations General Assembly. For reaction to President Biden's address and his meetings with other world leaders, I spoke with John Fortier, Senior Fellow at American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Well, John, as you know, the world leaders gathered this week in New York City at the United Nations headquarters for the annual United Nations General Assembly. And there we saw President Biden making his case when addressing the assembly that the world must remain united in defending Ukraine against Russian aggression. And also Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, he wrapped up his U.S. public relations tour that included speaking at the UNGA as well, and an Oval Office meeting with President Joe Biden. So will the U.S. succeed in helping Ukraine out of the war with Russia, either diplomatically or militarily?
Well, you did see President Biden make a strong statement in his speech to the General Assembly that we as Americans and we as world countries do not condone carving up of other countries and really standing strong with Ukraine in a general way, but also in a very specific way. So I think the statement was quite strong and the support he's indicating is quite strong. We do have some debates in Congress and some differences between the parties and some hurdles to get past to see if the type of financial support, military support that the U.S. provides will be quite as robust as before. So we're in the middle of that debate and there are some questions about it. But the statement of Joe Biden was strong at the UN.
And also there's a faction of House Republicans who are remaining steadfastly opposed to more Ukraine aid, even as other GOP lawmakers, primarily in the Senate, continue to advocate support for Kyiv to dissuade Russia from spreading its attacks beyond Ukraine's borders.
Well, I think you're right. There's division in the Republican Party. There certainly are strong supporters of Ukraine and the Ukraine funding in the Republican Party, but there is also a growing group that is worried about it, partly because they're in opposition, partly because some of the Republican Party is more worried about aid in that part of the world. We also have a presidential race going on in the background where Donald Trump and some other Republican candidates have been a little more negative about it. I still think there's a good expectation that there will be support for Ukraine, but the exact type of package and how it gets through and maybe the magnitude of it is a little bit uncertain with division in the Republican Party and Republicans being needed to pass budgets and appropriations given that they're in power in the House.
And then looking at some of the other highlights at the UNGA, President Biden, he sat down with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for their first meeting since Netanyahu took office at the helm of his country's far-right government late last year. How do you see U.S. relations progressing in the near future, or will they progress?
Well, I certainly think there is some tension between this administration and the Netanyahu government. And Israel is still a strong ally with the United States, and that relationship goes both ways. But I do think it's harder to negotiate with these two governments, which are not in agreement on a number of issues. So I don't think we're going to see a great breakdown in relations. But I also think that it's a bit of a rocky period and one that we will likely get through because I think the ultimate relationship between Israel and America is strong enough to. But there is some rocky time.
And also, President Biden was the only leader of the permanent five members of the UN Security Council to attend this year's UNGA.
For example, French President Emmanuel Macron is staying home, ready to greet King Charles and to work on deteriorating situations in Niger and Sudan. And there's been some others that would normally have come or sent someone and were not there. And some of the longtime attendees of the UNGA say this is not unusual. But did this weaken the event for President Biden?
You know, I think in the long run, we won't look back on this and think it was particularly different. I think there were some very particular circumstances for some of these leaders not coming. And I think President Biden performed well enough at the UN. I think in the United States, that is viewed sometimes through partisan lens, where Republicans and Democrats have different views of the importance of the UN. But as for the president and his party and for normal dealings with the UN, I think his visit went as well as he might have imagined, given the circumstances.
And finally, climate activists were protesting in the financial district of New York City earlier in the week, and some high-profile celebrities were also expected to make their cases in combating climate change. However, overall, in terms of looking at the world's priorities, where does the world stand in reducing greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, I think there have been broad commitments from a number of countries around the world, but I do think that in recent years, you've seen countries indicating that they might fall short of some of their ambitious goals. And that has something to do with domestic economic issues and the cost of these programs. Countries are still indicating their commitment to these levels, but you see in the UK and France, and probably to some extent indirectly in the United States, some indication that the progress or the amount of progress that we're going to make in the next few years as compared to what promised is not going to quite live up.
That was John Fortier, Senior Fellow at American Enterprise Institute. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis. Five Americans and two U.S. family members were released from prison this week as part of a rare prisoner swap with Tehran. The deal included unfreezing $6 billion in Iranian oil funds. Despite the deal, tensions are almost certain to remain high between the U.S. and Iran. I spoke with Geeta Aryan of VOA's Persian service for more insight on what this deal means. While the Biden administration has touted this agreement with Iran to unfreeze $6 billion of funds in exchange for the release of five American prisoners, and this comes after more than a year of indirect negotiations between Washington and Tehran as a diplomatic breakthrough. However, critics say Washington has catered to a foreign adversary it shouldn't have negotiated with in the first place. So, Geeta, can you tell us, why is the U.S. doing this deal with Iran?
Well, as you know, there were other instances in the past where Americans were taken hostage in Iran and they were freed under different agreements. This time, these five individuals have been there for a long time, especially one of them, Siamak Namazi, has been held in Iranian jail for 8 years. While the U.S. has been able to release a couple of others who were held briefly, much, much shorter than these individuals, in the past couple of years, the families of these individuals put lots of pressure on the Biden administration, criticizing him for not trying to get them out. And also the public opinion, the Iranian diaspora in the United States, they as well were very much critical of these people not having been paid enough attention to by the Biden administration. That's what they claim. And therefore, the administration set out, and as you explained, started a dialogue over a year ago.
Lawmakers in the U.S., Republicans, and even some Democrats fear that such a deal encourages hostile nations to take more Americans traveling abroad as hostages in the future. Is this a justifiable concern?
It certainly is, because Iran has a history of taking hostages. And if you go back 44 years at the beginning of the revolution, they took 44 U.S. diplomats and U.S. government employees at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran hostage. After that, similar incidents have happened. And therefore, it is very possible. And not only the Iranian regime has taken U.S. citizens, but dual citizens from other countries as well, from European countries and elsewhere. The Iranian economy is in a very bad state, and experts analyze and they say that this is one way for Iran to bring money back into the country, inject it into the economy, although this money is not going to the Iranian government directly, as the U.S. Officials have stressed.
And looking at the money issue, which is about $6 to maybe $7 billion of frozen assets that were initially part of an agreement South Korea owed Iran for oil it purchased but had not yet paid, as the Trump administration imposed sanctions on such transactions in 2019. So when you're looking at this, you're looking at Iran's economy. Still, there is criticism that this money could help boost Iran's economy at a time when Iran poses a growing threat to U.S. troops and Mideast allies.
Kim, number one, the Biden administration is very adamant that the money in the two South Korean banks were not frozen, and that Iran was able to withdraw that as much as it wanted from that fund, from those accounts, to make non-sanctionable purchases, even in the past. But Iran chose not to, now for various reasons. And it put lots of pressure on the South Korean government to release the money. However, South Korea, being an ally of the U.S., did not want to violate U.S. sanctions and was in communication and consultation with the United States. Now, with this deal, what the Biden administration has done is transfer that money elsewhere, which is Qatar, and the money, which is $6 billion, has been converted into euro and deposited in accounts in Qatar. So the Islamic Republic of Iran could only purchase, once again, non-sanctionable goods, food, medicine, humanitarian goods, as well as agricultural items as well. So this money is not going directly into the Iranian economy. The Biden administration says it's going to keep its eyes fixed on how that money is being used. The Treasury Department will be seeing how much money Iran is going to be using for what purposes. That is how this deal about the money is going to work.
That was Geeta Aryan of VOA's Persian Service speaking with me. As Washington and Tehran implemented a prisoner exchange earlier this week, new details emerged about the uncertain status of three of the five Iranians who were granted clemency by Washington and remained on U.S. soil. Michael Lippin, host of VOA's weekly radio show Flashpoint Iran, talked with me about the discovery of new information.
Yes, this has been one element of the U.S.-Iran prisoner exchange that has not been covered so much by other news outlets, and that is, of course, the Iranians whom the U.S. agreed to grant clemency to as part of this arrangement with the Iranian side. You know, the Iranians had long insisted that if we're going to release five American citizens, we want five of our own people who are in the U.S. and who are either convicted of federal charges or indicted on federal charges. They wanted those people to be granted clemency and released as well, five for five. So what I've learned is that three of those five who have remained in the U.S., those three men were granted clemency by President Joe Biden in letters that he signed on September 14th. Those letters were visible in the U.S. Government's PACER system, which displays court filings and federal cases. And I was able to take a look at those letters. President Biden commuted the sentence of one of those men, Kambiz Attarkashani. He had been in prison, already convicted, due to be released in February, but the commutation meant that he got out of prison 5 months early. And President Biden also signed pardons for two other men, Kaveh Lotfullah Afrasiabi and Amin Hassanzadeh. They had been indicted, but not yet faced trial, not yet convicted. They were, in fact, awaiting trial in both cases for a period of several years. So they have been pardoned. There were two other Iranians who were granted clemency under this arrangement. They actually left the U.S. They were flown to Qatar, arrived there Monday, and then after a short period of time, flew on to Tehran, and they arrived late Monday night.
That's very interesting. And what is the significance of this information, and what can be expected from it?
What is significant about the statuses of these five individuals is that, you know, Iran was able to get the U.S. to grant clemency to all five. That is true. But not all of them went back to Iran. As we all know, the five Americans who were freed by the Iranian side and whom the U.S. said were wrongfully detained over there, they all came back to the U.S. and were reunited with their loved ones. And of course, we're very happy to come back to the U.S., as we can all imagine. But it's not the case that the five Iranians who were granted clemency all went back to Iran. Only two of them went. The other three, the three who have remained in the U.S., one who got the commutation and the other two who got the pardons, have not desired to go back to Iran. One of them is a U.S.-Iranian dual national. That's Kambiz Attarkashani. So one might expect him to want to stay in the U.S. The other two, one of them is a permanent resident of the U.S. That's Kaveh Lotfullah Afrasiabi. And Amin Hassanzadeh had been a U.S. permanent resident for a number of years, but his permanent residency actually expired last month on August 23rd, according to a court filing that I saw. So all three of those men have ties to the U.S., and for their own reasons, have wanted to stay here, and they did not request to get on a plane and go back to Iran. And for the Iranian side, it perhaps could be a little bit embarrassing that not all five of the people whom they tried hard to get granted clemency, not all of them wanted to come back to their country of origin. What has also been interesting for me to learn is that the commutation and the pardons that were granted to the three who stayed here in the U.S. were all conditional. The conditions attached to the clemencies basically said that all three of them have to behave. In addition to committing any further crimes, they are barred from, for example, trying to profit from selling their stories to media outlets through writing books and so on. So basically, they have to be on their best behavior. Otherwise, President Biden said in the letters that he retains the right, and so do future presidents, to either put one of them back in prison to serve the rest of his sentence or remove the pardons from the other two and put them back into a situation of awaiting trial.
That was Michael Lippin, host of VOA's weekly radio show, Flashpoint Iran. The UAW, United Auto Workers Union, is expanding its historic strike against Detroit's three major U.S. automakers. For more insight on the importance of the automotive industry to the U.S. economy, I spoke with automotive expert Akash Arora, managing director and partner at Boston Consulting Group and North America leader for the automotive and mobility practice. Thank you, Akash, for taking the time to speak with me. Roughly 13,000 workers walked out of three plants in Missouri, Michigan, and Ohio, one plant belonging to each of the big Detroit automakers, early Friday after negotiators failed to agree on contracts before the 11:59 p.m. Thursday deadline. The walkout is the first in the union's history against all three automakers. But before we talk about the impact of this strike, Akash, can you tell us first how important the auto industry is to the U.S. economy?
Absolutely. So the auto industry is roughly about 3% of the American GDP. So this is quite an important industry. And then there are a number of downstream and upstream industries that are tied to the auto industry. So the footprint is even larger than that. So I would say very important to the overall economy.
The walkout began after the carmakers' offers failed to meet the UAW's demands for a double-digit wage increase over 4 years, reinstatement of cost of living pay increases, and more paid time off. So what kind of impact will this strike have on the auto industry?
Yeah, the impact will be, I would say, quite severe, depending on how long the strike runs. So most of the OEMs where the strike is taking place have good inventory, anywhere from 50 to 70 days, or in some cases, even a little bit more than that. So for near term, the industry can absorb some of the impacts, especially like in terms of delivering vehicles to the consumers. If the strike continues for longer term, then the impact can be quite big. Our estimate, if it continues at these plants only, then somewhere around almost like $500 million in EBIT across all of the OEMs. But if it is continuing at these plants only, which is not guaranteed, like this could expand to plants beyond. But this impact will get bigger also as the inventories run out.
Also, U.S. lawmakers are on opposing sides when it comes to President Biden's policies on electric vehicles, with some resisting EVs. As an automotive expert, what are your views on EV penetration in the U.S. and domestic supply chains of EVs?
I do think that the penetration of EVs will continue to improve. There are a number of factors that drive the penetration of EVs, obviously regulation being one of them, but beyond regulation, there's also the total cost of ownership. And then there is also the availability from the OEMs. As these factors move in the same direction, the penetration will continue to increase. Our view is, we just released a report. We will share it with you today. We released it last week. Our view is that in the U.S., by 2030, the penetration close to 50% of battery electric and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. This, of course, depends on the cost of batteries continue to come down and the materials continue to become or stay available. And if the material shortage becomes one of the factors, then the penetration will be lower than that. It might take another year or two to get to that level of penetration, the 50% by 2030.
That was Akash Arora, Managing Director and Partner at Boston Consulting Group and North America leader for the automotive and mobility practice. Well, that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for listening. And for more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition, Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Kim Lewis.